Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari American, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
They're gonna kill the love of my life.
Casey!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
This Friday.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal a truck, bring it to me, then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain, for love.
Collide, in theaters Friday. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13.
When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy for you to create your stunning website. Go to Wix.com and create your website today. It's easy and free. That's Wix.com.
Welcome to the RotoWire Basketball Podcast brought to you by DraftKings.com. DraftKings is the leader in daily fantasy sports. As always, you can use that promo code ROTOHOOPS, R-O-T-O-H-O-O-P-S, all one word. When you deposit on DraftKings, it'll get you a free contest entry today with your first deposit. All right, it is Thursday, January 7th, the year 2016. Nick Whalen here, as I always am, on Thursdays with James Anderson. James, how's it going?
Pretty good. You just got some financial advice, I believe.
So I did. I just got a bunch of a little bit. I met with our financial advisor who came into the office just before we recorded, paid a surprise visit from said financial advisor. And I can tell you, I know absolutely nothing about anything to do with finance. And it's basically this meeting like brought me back to my nightmares of freshman year econ 101, up at the social sciences building on the campus of UW-Madison. And that was probably the worst class I ever took throughout college. And there were a couple doozies freshman and sophomore year, but that one was the worst. And there were like three or four times during this meeting, we won't talk too much about it, that I think I asked questions that elicited a couple looks from the financial guy who was just like, what the hell are you talking about?
My move in meetings like that is to just like nod my head and just like try to portray like a look like I totally know what I'm talking about, but not like say anything stupid.
I thought I knew a little bit about like what the stock market was, but I think I misinterpreted a couple terms along the way. I'm glad there are people in the world that understand things like that, because I don't at all.
All right, well, let's dig into some NBA.
First of all, I wanted to ask you, there's some big news. 30 for 30 ESPN. they announced at least some of their new documentaries coming out for, I guess this is a third or fourth season, if you want to call it that, as they continue to roll out more excellent documentaries. The first one of this season is going to be on the 85 Bears, which is going to be cool. I'm sure that'll be a lot of fun. But there is one that pertains to the NBA, and that's going to be about the 90s Magic. And it's pretty loosely defined, I should say, for now. Not a ton of details, but it's going to be executive produced by Shaq and Penny. And what executive produce means, we're not really sure. But either way, it means that these guys are definitely going to be big parts of the documentary. And I know you're a big Penny guy. Is he your favorite NBA player of all time?
Yeah.
And is that 90s Magic team, or, you know, the mid-90s, is that like your favorite era of basketball for one certain team?
Yeah, I think it's tough because that team was, I mean, that's why they're doing a documentary on it. It's such a kind of crazy situation because that team was cut way too short, like in terms of the run they had. So, you know, for probably two years there, they were probably my favorite team, my favorite 2-year run of team. has ever had, or my favorite team to watch for a 2-year run, I should say. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Penny in his prime, or you could even say like he might have been pre what should have been his prime, like in his rookie year and in his second year. Just kind of a crazy player to watch. I don't think we've ever really seen anything quite like that since then. And of course, Shaq, you know, skinny Shaq, like completely dominant. Shaq was great to watch as well.
Yeah, I kind of missed that era of Orlando Magic basketball, unfortunately. I got into the Magic when T-Mac was there. So what was that, like 2001? And the supporting cast was not quite the same that it was during the Penny days. I'm trying to think who's even on that roster.
Like Dennis Scott had like one of the greatest 3-point shooting seasons of all time that year. Like he had like like 3-pointers in a season. Like he was like still like, I don't know if he was first or second or third all time, but that record stood forever until
267 made threes, shot 43% from three. That was in 95-96.
Like that's way before like teams were using the 3-pointer that way. And like the fact that a guy back then had a record in 3-pointers that has stood, I don't even know if it's been broken yet. I know Steph Curry's going to obliterate it this year.
But Curry's got the record.
Did he set it last year?
I believe so. I'm trying to find the,
because like that,
Curry definitely has that though.
Okay, because Scott had it for like a long time. Like he had it until at least a few years ago. So like that's kind of crazy. I mean, that's definitely separated them from the pack.
Right. Curry has the top two right now. So Curry last season, 14-15, had 286. He's going to obliterate that this year. He had 272 in 2012-13. Ray Allen had 269 in 05-06. But yeah, Dennis Scott, 267 in 95-96. So there was a 10-year gap before Ray Allen broke that, where I would assume no one really got overly close.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty solid third wheel to have, especially considering, I mean, the pieces they had in Shaq and Penny. Penny, you know, he could shoot a little bit, but not the type of guy you want to have taking 5 or 6 threes a game. So Scott worked perfectly. Nick Anderson was awesome until he gagged in that finals. You know, a lot of supporting pieces to go with that squad. So Brian Shaw was on that team.
You never really think of Dennis Scott as like an all-time great three-point shooter. At least I don't. And then look at the numbers. I mean, he's made more three-pointers in a single season than guys like Peja Stojakovic, Reggie Miller, Quinn Richardson, Rashard Lewis.
I think it's because Scott's like peak was so short. Like I think I don't remember how long he was doing stuff like that, but I don't think it was for more than a 2 or 3 year run. So that's kind of why I think he gets forgotten.
Record for 3-point attempts in a season is George McLeod. Hey. I don't know who that is. 95-96 Dallas. Antoine Walker jumps into the top five, despite not being in the top 20 in made field goals in a season. He's in the top five in attempts.
Oh, hey. You know, shooters got to shoot.
He attempted like 30 more 3-pointers in one season than Curry did last season. I don't know. I don't want to get into the Antoine Walker advanced 3-point stats. That's a story for another pod. But we'll talk a little bit about a couple of the storylines from Wednesday night. Wednesday, always a big night in the NBA as far as large slates of games. A pretty ugly slate on Thursday night. Jazz Rockets, about the only intriguing game on the schedule. I guess Bulls Celtics, but Boston's kind of fallen off of late. But Kyrie Irving, I think, is officially back. And he was maybe officially back last week, but probably his best game to date, as he goes 14 of 22 from the field last night, 32 points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals, out-dueling John Wall, who finished with 20 and 12 for Washington. I mean, when Kyrie's back and when he's playing like this, is this team, you know, right up there with the Warriors and the Spurs, or are they still, you know, one tier below, maybe with the Thunder?
I would still pick them to lose in 5 or 6 to either the Spurs or the Warriors, but I definitely think that it's not even close in the East when they're going like this. Like I think they could easily maybe lose 1 or 2 games on the way to the finals. So
this is 2 games in a row where the opponent, they played Toronto the other night, the opponent has played really well. Washington shot 55% in this game. They hit 14 threes, shot 58%. You know, from 3, 31 assists, 63% from, or that's not great from the line, I guess, but 17 made free throws. Like, usually when you see those numbers, that team wins the game, and they don't, you know. Cleveland scored 121 points in this game.
I think Cleveland's, or at least why they're not as aesthetically pleasing to me as some of those other teams, is that they don't have a five-man unit that I just love the way the pieces all fit together. Like, they have like seven or eight guys who just by themselves are really quality basketball players, but they don't have like that perfect five-man unit that I think they could run out against anyone and have a ton of success with reliably. I mean, I think there's, you know, the fact like if they play the Warriors or they play the Spurs, they're going to run into some serious issues up front with who are they going to have on the court in those big possessions at the end of games, because and this is kind of why I was kind of never of the opinion that Kevin Love was like a franchise guy, not a guy that I would have traded Andrew Wiggins for. We're going to get to Wiggins in a second, but just not a franchise guy, because the defense is so lacking that he becomes kind of a liability on that end. And if you are not running your offense through him, then like the stuff you're getting on the other end isn't really worth having on the court in certain situations.
So since Kyrie's been back, that Irving, LeBron, Love, JR, and Thompson lineup has an offensive rating of 130.7. And obviously that's a smaller sample size, and you know it's only been 65 minutes together. But, I mean, is that what lineup? You know, we talked about what lineup can they go to in certain situations. And they're a team that's going to have to adjust to, you know, what San Antonio brings and what Golden State brings, whoever they face or whoever they would face in the finals. Are there going to be times where we might see Kyrie Irving on the bench in the fourth quarter for extended stretches because they need Dellavedova's defense?
No. I think you could see Kevin Love on the bench for extended stretches, but I think Kyrie's just – like we saw before Kyrie got hurt last year, it's kind of an effort thing. I mean, it really always is an effort thing on defense, but when he's, you know, in the postseason – he's not really dogging it, especially in a matchup against a guy like Curry. Like, he's not going to just let himself get wasted every possession on the other end. So I'm fine with having him out there. But, yeah, I think – and just the drop-off is just so crazy between him and Dellavedova offensively that it just doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, it's hard to figure out how they're going to do it. I mean, you look at the two lineups that have played at least 100 minutes together, the two best five-man lineups in terms of net rating both belong to Golden State. So, I mean, you're pretty much running into a buzzsaw there as far as the lineups they can throw together. But Cleveland has guys, though. I mean, you have guys like Anderson Varejao, who you don't want playing big minutes, but this is a guy who going into last season they thought would be a huge contributor to this team. Mo Williams, basically been a DMP CD type of guy lately, and you know, who are they bringing off the bench, you know, in the playoffs last year as their backup point guard? Do they really even have one?
The Cavs?
Yeah.
Shoot. I mean,
they had to have somebody, right? But, like, did they – it seemed like it was always Deli out there or LeBron just manning the point, or even they went JR handling it sometimes.
That was a mess. I mean, I should note, like, when you reference that offensive efficiency of that five-man unit you're talking about for them, I mean, they've played –
65 minutes.
The Blazers, the Suns, the Nuggets,
right.
The Magic, the Raptors, the Wizards. I mean, those are the teams they've played with that unit. So it's not like they've ran into any legitimate teams. And there's really only a few teams that I think could successfully exploit that. And we're going to talk about some coaches in a minute here. But, I mean, it's not like you're going to be able to exploit that if you're Randy Whitman and the Wizards or what have you.
Right, that's true. But, I mean, even before Kyrie came back, you know, the Love-LeBron-Deli lineup, the Deli-Love-Thompson lineup was looking pretty good for this team. So, I mean, we'll see how things end up once, you know, where they're at even health-wise going into the playoffs. I mean, that's certainly nothing to be taken for granted at this point. But another thing to be concerned about a little bit, at least with this team, and especially if you're looking at it from a fantasy perspective, is Kevin Love pre-Kyrie Irving, 17.6 points per game, 10.8 rebounds, 2.7 assists, shooting 43% and taking 14 shots a game. Now, since Kyrie's been back, that's been down to 12.4 points per game. Rebounds been right about the same, 10.3. One fewer assists per game, 1.8. 39% shooting and taking three fewer shots per game. I mean, this is something had to give, right? I mean, with Kyrie coming back, a guy who's going to take 20 shots on a lot of nights, mm-hmm. it's just kind of by default, some of those are going to come off of Love before they're going to come off of a guy like LeBron or even J.R. Smith shooting totals.
Yeah, probably too late to trade Love in fantasy if you have him, but I kind of see more of the same going forward.
The shooting percentage thing is so odd to me. He's never been a guy who's He's been very inefficient for a power forward. You know, usually you want, where do you want a power forward shooting percentage wise? Like minimum of like 47, 48?
Yeah.
And this is a guy, even in Minnesota, you know, when he was at his quote unquote peak, he was shooting in the mid to low 40s.
It's, I mean, he's always been pretty overrated, I think. And that's, you know, in Cleveland, it hurts because he's not really getting the ball. Like in Minnesota, he got the ball wherever he wanted it, like whenever he wanted it. And it's a lot easier to put up, you know, solid shooting percentages in that scenario. Whereas here, he's kind of getting it in spots that he's not necessarily comfortable working from. And I mean, it's just, it's not a good fit for him. He's got to have, I'd love to kind of get inside his head and just sort of see where he kind of wishes his NBA career was or where he wishes he was playing right now. Cause it's just kind of such a,
do you feel like he got like bullied into staying in Cleveland almost? I don't know. I don't have any information on this, obviously. It just seemed to me like he was kind of challenged by LeBron and, you know, this organization almost to say like, you know, last year wasn't great for you, but you're just going to ditch on us. You know, like you got an opportunity to win a title here. You should probably come back. And then it seemed like he was all, you know, oh yeah, I'm locked in. I'm ready to go. But like, where are the indications that like he's actually really happy with his position?
No. Yeah, I mean, I just don't think he, you know, it would have sort of seemed like he was a quitter.
It would have
seemed like he didn't take winning wasn't the most important thing.
I think that's what it was. Is had he walked away, there would have been that label of he would rather take the money or take the being the number one guy on a bad team.
And I don't know. I mean, I think if you're that good of a player and you're not like, he's just not the type of player who strike, like his game isn't even the type of game that works as like a supporting guy, really. I mean, like he
needs to be
a
better defender to be a supporting guy. Like you have to play D.
Like he just has that type of game that just screams good numbers, bad team.
Yep.
Like, and I feel like maybe he didn't want to embrace that as his destiny. And I respect that, but it's just not a great fit for him to kind of maximize his basketball skills.
The one thing he can do is shoot the three, though, and that's big. If he couldn't shoot the three and if he was kind of more of like an Al Jefferson type of, you know, back down, which basically he would be David Lee if he couldn't shoot the three, and we saw what happened to him. He fell out of a championship rotation. But interestingly, I mean, Love's usage is right up there with where it was during his first All-Star season in Minnesota. That's kind of surprising to me. It's up a couple points over last season, so they're definitely making a concerted effort to get him the ball. But when I watch Cleveland as much as anybody other than Milwaukee, and it just, he doesn't seem dominant. He gets a lot of like, you know, post touches that kind of end in like weak, you know, weak moves where he just doesn't seem like he has the same kind of savviness in the post, the same kind of confidence in the post. And it, I don't know, he just kind of feels like the Chris Bosh role for this team, but he doesn't play nearly as good a defense as Chris Bosh. He's not as versatile as Bosh defensively. And I think he kind of looks for the three ball more than Bosh ever did.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we've kind of covered Love's inefficiencies. Right. I mean, he's just kind of he's become a role player, and it's not, I mean, he doesn't scare you when you play the Cavs on a night-to-night basis.
Right. The nice thing is he's like, they can win without him. They kind of showed that last year. And even if he plays a minor role for them, you know, come playoff time, come finals time, like, he's still a guy that you don't mind having, you know, as a weapon. Even if you end up having to play Tristan Thompson in a lot of spots, you know, having Kevin Love for 20 to 25 minutes is a pretty damn good luxury. Let's talk Hassan Whiteside. So he played last night. There were some issues with his knee lately. Doesn't look like it's going to be anything serious. He played 28 minutes, just 8-8, which for him is, you know, about as low of a total of combined rebounds and points as you're going to see, just one block. But Zach Lowe released a new podcast on Thursday morning. Brian Windhorst, ESPN's LeBron reporter, was the guest on that. And he had an interesting quote about Whiteside, somewhat confirming kind of what we already knew or what a lot of people suspected about the situation. But Windhorst said, quote, "This is a guy," talking about Whiteside, "who's going to get a max contract this summer. He's absolutely not a Heat player. His style of play, his personality, the way he goes about his business is not congruent with the way the Heat normally go about themselves." What exactly does that mean? I mean, is this just kind of the Whiteside really hasn't grown up maybe as much as it looks like on the court?
I just think there's a big gap between his stats and his true worth to like a team with championship aspirations. He's obviously got off the court issues. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, you can kind of just kind of guess at what those might be, whether it be, you know, smoking weed or coming to practice late or not putting forth effort in practice or not doing what the coaches are instructing them to do on a play-to-play basis. But all you really have to do is just kind of watch the games to not to see that it's a lot of those block shots are sort of negated by the times he tries to block shots and then exposes the rim. Like, I mean, he'll go up hard trying to block a shot, and then you know, the guy maybe passes to his defender, like it comes off his defender trying to protect the rim, and then leaves his defender wide open, or you know, goes hard for the block, the guy pump fakes, and then he's completely out of the play. Like, it's not, the block shots aren't the result of him just being an excellent defender. They're just him chasing stats. So if he's not playing within the scheme that Spo's trying to run and he's kind of going after his own stats, then that's kind of what I think that quote means a little bit.
And he's, like, weirdly open about chasing stats, too. Like, and he kind of he had some quote, like, a few weeks back. Somebody asked him about the blocks, and he – something about, like, oh, it's as good as a missed shot or as good as a rebound or something. And it's just like, no, it's not. But – at the same time, this is a really good player. Like, we don't mean to take away too much from Whiteside. I mean, he has his faults. I think he's not as good. When you see players who block shots at a high volume, you kind of automatically assume, like, oh, he's the best defensive center in the league. He has the highest block rate in league history right now. But, like, is he actually a good defender, or is he a good shot blocker who's an average defender?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think he's, like, average, maybe. If you were to line up the 30 best defensive centers in the league, I'm not sure he'd be in the top 10. He'd definitely be in the top 20. But if you're gonna, you know, have a guy go against the Spurs or the Warriors or the Thunder in a playoff series, I think that he could get exposed for sure. So I mean, I definitely think he's very overrated based on the stats.
So Windhorst went on to say, quote, the Heat have a decision to make. Do you ride out the season with Whiteside, or do you package him with Luol Deng before the deadline? And the caveat with Deng being involved is that Whiteside's on a minimum deal. There's no bird rights involved. He's basically a veteran's minimum guy, or what, I don't even know if he qualifies for the full veteran's minimum, being still a young player, but he's on a minimum salary. So if Miami wants to trade him, you know, they can't trade him straight up for, I mean, it's a super far-fetched, but like DeMarcus Cousins, because DeMarcus Cousins is being paid to his value, whereas Whiteside is being paid well below his value. So that they would obviously have to attach someone with him, unless they're going to trade for basically someone on a rookie contract or a minimum contract. If you're the Heat, are you comfortable going into the playoffs with Whiteside as one of your, you know, your solidified starters, or do you think you could do better by flipping him somewhere?
Well, you don't get to, if you got to make trades like a week before the playoffs, I think that would maybe be, I guess at that point they would have lost kind of all leverage because he's going to be a free agent. But I think they could use him, or at least use a player that's significantly better than Chris Anderson, which he is, for the rest of the regular season. And I think that he could come in handy against a team like the Bulls if they ran into them in the postseason. I think he'd be pretty useful maybe against a team like the Raptors or the Pistons, but I think that they should be worried about beating the Cavs and then trying to contend against the teams in the West. And I think that their best lineup against those teams is Bosch at center for, you know, at least 20-25 minutes of the game. And in that case, I don't think they really need him to win a title. But I wonder where they would look to possibly move him. I know on that podcast, Windhorst threw out the idea of the Pelicans sending Ryan Anderson to the Heat in exchange for Deng and Whiteside. And I don't really see why that would appeal to the Pelicans at all, because
even the Heat, like, they have Josh McRoberts.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd rather have Ryan Anderson than Whiteside. Deng, maybe. It's debatable, but I definitely don't see why the Pelicans would do it, because you're not contending this year, so it doesn't really matter if you get Whiteside. You're going to have Whiteside hanging out with Anthony Davis.
That's the real kicker.
There's no real reason for that.
That's a team. The Whiteside thing, you don't trade for Hassan Whiteside unless you somehow get some sort of commitment that he's going to re-sign with you. And I don't know. I don't see that being realistic. Or you have to be a contender, because this is a guy who's on an expiring deal. He's going to hit the open market, and there are going to be teams who will max him out. That's a given. So if you want to get him as a half season rental, that's great. But you also have.
I don't think he's going to get dealt just because I don't see a team that's going to try to get him.
I don't know though, because Miami doesn't really have a huge incentive to keep him unless they're going for it this year, which they are. I mean, they're a quote unquote contender in the East, depending on what you think about Cleveland and whether or not they're beatable by an East team. But
if you're trading him, if you're trading Whiteside, it's got to be to a team that's also contending this year.
Right.
And I don't see them making a trade with like a team like the Pacers or the Hawks, because it's like, are those teams that close in the East going to swap parts? I just don't think that.
I don't know
that.
I think Miami, if you're Miami, like, you kind of want to get rid of him, right? Because you're saying, like, you either think you have such a good chance this year and he's such a big part of that you keep him, but, like, if you can flip him and get somebody who you can either, use as an asset going forward, whether you want them as part of your team or as a possible trade type of asset, because you can't trade Whiteside after the deadline, that's great. But what you could also do is, try to get, like, a Whiteside and Deng for, like, Al Horford, who could be on your team for the next 2 or 3 years.
You seriously think the Hawks would do that?
No, I don't think they would, but that's not like a completely ludicrous deal.
I think they'd laugh at that phone call.
Yeah,
they're getting
depth
for 1 year of Whiteside and Deng. Like, I think that's crazy.
I don't think it would happen. If I'm the Hawks, I wouldn't hang up the phone. I would hang up the phone after
it up emphatically, and I'd do the thing where you hang it up multiple times.
Oh, okay.
Hung it up.
Whenever we talk about trade phone calls, I picture that iconic photo of Joe Dumars on two phones, like, glancing at the camera, like, yeah, you caught me. Well, the thing about, like, the Hawks is, like, they're kind of in flux too. Like, they're one of their better players, a key part of that core, an all-star somehow. Kyle Korver is 34, 35 years old. Al Horford's not getting any younger. They're kind of at the point where, like, if they want to go forward with this core, are they really going to get any better? Like, Paul Millsap's on a short-term deal. He's getting close to 30, if not already.
I think their move is to trade Schroeder, and I don't think they would even consider anything that would disrupt that Teague, Millsap, Horford, Korver core, because, like, continuity is, like, their greatest strength. Like, once you get rid of that, then you just have a bunch of, like, non-top 20 players playing together and trying to figure out how to play with each other. I think that, like, moving Schroeder at least could get you that fifth piece in your starting lineup that gives you a great five-man unit to kind of live or die with in the postseason. But moving Horford and bringing in a guy with all of Whiteside's baggage, like, Luol Deng's, he's not done, but he's not going to get you over the hump. And I think that just risks kind of ruining the continuity you have with your starting five. So if I was them, I agree that they're not going to contend with their current roster, but I think the only real way to improve this group while not risking making it significantly worse is to move Schroeder or maybe a draft pick and try to get one great small forward shooting guard type to add to that lineup.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Atlanta is just the presence of LeBron in Cleveland and what that means for the rest of the East, it presents such a big challenge that, like, it's not enough to just have your continuity and, like, you're aiming to knock off one team for the next 4 or 5 years. And, like, what Atlanta has right now isn't going to be close.
Well, I would argue that their ceiling is greater right now than it is with Whiteside and Deng if they lose Horford personally.
Yeah, maybe that was a bad example. I think teams, basically my point overall is that I think teams are maybe going to be willing to take more of those type of risks, because it's like, well, we're either beating the Cavs or we're not getting anywhere. It's like you basically need to say, like, we need to do something, because being the 2 through 8 seed just means we're going to get knocked off by this team every year, and, like, we need to shake things up, or there's not going to be any chance of getting where we want to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get it. I just don't think Whiteside's really all that appealing to teams that are, like, if it'd be one thing, I think the Heat would still be willing to move him if he had, like, 3 years left on his deal. I think they'd be shopping him pretty aggressively, and in that case, I think they'd have a ton of buyers, because, like, teams like, the Nets or whoever, like the Wizards, the the Nuggets, like tons of teams that aren't contending would roll the dice on him if they could keep him next year. But the fact that his contract expires this year, I don't think there's any contenders that are a good fit in that trade market.
Not really. I mean, you look at like Indiana or something, the teams that need front court guys, but what would they have to send back that Miami would be into? Before we move on quickly, the second NBA All-Star ballots just returned within the last like 5 minutes here as we record. LeBron still on top in the front court in the East, Paul George and Andre Drummond still 2 and 3. I believe that's how it was on the first return as well. Kobe Bryant has 300,000 more votes than anyone else, now up to 1.2 million. So he's going to be starting. He's basically doubled up KD in the Western Conference front court. Draymond Green, though, jumps up. I think Blake Griffin was in there initially. Griffin obviously hasn't played in a couple of weeks. He's down at number 5. So Bryant, Durant, and Draymond are the top 3 in the West front court. Kawhi, though, just 2,000 behind Draymond Green. And Blake Griffin still fairly close, about 32,000 back, which sounds like a lot, but really isn't that many. East guards, Wade and Kyrie, still there. Kyle Lowry closing in on Kyrie, though. But the way that Kyrie's playing, that's going to be a tough battle. I feel like Kyle Lowry's going to end up jumping him just because the game's in Toronto, and that Toronto fan base is going to come on strong at the end.
That's the Kyrie versus Lowry thing is the most interesting race, I think.
Wade's already got this locked up. I mean, Wade's basically 300,000 ahead of both of those guys.
I also wonder, like, I'm surprised that Wade, what are the votes, Wade versus Blake Griffin? I know they're not competing together, but
Wade's
what
at 562,000 roughly, and Griffin is at 298,000.
See, like, I would have guessed that those two were very close in terms of public popularity, and so I guess I'm surprised that they're so far apart. Like, Blake just seems like one of those guys that, like, little kids like and foreigners like and stuff like that, so...
Damn foreigners.
They vote a ton. they stack those ballots.
I don't vote. Do you ever vote for the All-Star game? Like, no. I never. I like jokingly
I
voted
like
for Zaza.
The people that love the NBA the most and like watch it the most and know the most about it vote the least.
Yeah.
Like, it's not. I mean, that's why you should never get angry when like someone doesn't get voted to start the game. It's like, well, it's not for you. Like that. Yeah. That's not those. You're not the person that's voting. So. I'm just sort of surprised that Wade is that much more. Maybe it just speaks to the lack of options in the East and the competition Blake has in the West. But yeah, that Kyrie. Do you have a prediction? You think Lowry's going
to
pass him?
I want it to be Kyrie. I don't know. I'm a Kyrie sympathizer. I love his game, but I think it's going to be Lowry just because the city of Toronto is huge, and I think I think he was actually on some podcast recently, and basically I think it might have been Woj or maybe it was Zach Lowe. And he basically said they asked him about that, and he kind of said something like, "Oh yeah, you know, like Toronto, it's always late to the vote. That's what happened last year."
Well, I just don't. I think it's hard to argue that Kyle Lowry's not more deserving. I mean, he's gonna have played twice
they're both
as many
deserving.
Games, but are they both deserving like to play in the All-Star game? Like Kyle Lowry's carrying a team all season long. Kyrie Irving's played like less than 10 games so far. Like
Patrick Patterson's carrying that team.
I just think that I think Lowry's more deserving, but I'd rather see Kyrie just because Kyrie's the type of player that can put on a show in a game like that.
If Kyrie doesn't get in, will he be picked by the coaches? Do you think they might hold the games played number against him? Because if Lowry doesn't get in, he'll get picked by the coaches, like no question.
Yeah.
But Kyrie, I don't know.
So it would be the... I'll say he gets in from the coaches. I just think that they're going to look at the Cavs and how much better they are than everyone else in the East, and they're going to have no problem throwing. Because it's not like anyone other than LeBron's going to get in if Kyrie doesn't. So I think that they'd be fine having him be the second Cav in.
Yeah, that's the other thing is like the Cavs record-wise are going to be so good that like Kevin Love's probably not going to get in. So no. it's either a Pachulia or a Pachulia.
Pachulia or Kyrie. It's going to come down to those.
Pachulia is not even on the. He's not even on the returns. How is he not top 15?
Wow, man,
this is ridiculous. Is there like another category? Front court, back court.
Be a typo.
Yeah, I don't. I don't. I think they misspelled Zaza Pachulia as Kawhi Leonard. All right, so let's talk a little bit about coaches. Excuse me. This is something that you talked about last night. Is something we've been kind of wanting to touch on the podcast for a while. But Basically, we just want to go through and rank our top 10 coaches and then our bottom five coaches.
Yes.
Which one do you want to start with?
How about we do bottom five really quick, and then I think we got to
take a break.
We got to take a quick break. So let's try to get through the top five here, or the bottom five.
Bottom five. All right. So who's your bottom one? I think these might match up.
This is more fun, I think, than the top 10. Byron Scott, bottom of the barrel for me. Controversial, I know, but
very.
The only case you can make that Byron Scott isn't bottom one is that everything he's doing is basically exactly what he's being told to do by management / Kobe Bryant, who's also a hand of management. So that would be the case in support of Byron Scott only being the 29th best coach. But I just think we've seen enough. Like, the fact that he's playing Nick Young and Lou Williams minutes, like, is kind of insane. Because it's like,
it's very insane.
I'm fine with him playing Kobe like 32 minutes a game or whatever, because it's, you know, that's what the people want to see. But you got to play Clarkson and D'Angelo Russell. Like, you could still play those two 30 minutes a game as well with Kobe if you're not playing Lou Williams and Nick Young. Nick Young should not play, like, period. Like, he's a complete...
How is he, like, tough enough to play, but, like Julius Randle is just not?
Nick Young is, like, he might be, like, the worst, like... pure basketball player, like, in
watch
the
it.
League in terms of
watch
like
it.
Wins and losses, like,
no.
I mean, he's so bad, he shouldn't be playing. That's what you have too for bottom coach.
His nickname, Nick Young's nickname on Basketball Reference, other than Swaggy P, is Bean Burrito. Do we know anything about that?
Don't know anything about that.
But yeah, Byron Scott is my lowest. I think this is... Has there ever been a time like this where there's like one coach who's like so astoundingly bad compared to everyone else? Like, mm-hmm. Not that I can really remember. Like, usually there's always like two or three that you don't love, but like he is like solidifying himself as the worst coach in the league.
And speaking of coaches who hate three-pointers, Sam Mitchell's my second worst.
Yep. And he's my second worst as well. I think most people would probably agree with that.
It's kind of crazy because you could make a case that like the Lakers and the T-Wolves have maybe top three collections of like young talent on their rosters right now in the league, talent that needs to be developed and coached up, and yet they're entrusting those duties to the two worst coaches in the league. So that's not very encouraging.
It is not. So who's your third worst?
This is where it gets a little interesting.
I know. I don't... Because there's two clear ones, and then after that, it's kind of subjective.
So I felt like the bottom five was very clear, but ordering 26 through 28 was tough for me. I said the third worst is Randy Whitman.
So did I.
Oh, nice.
No way. I think that was kind of low-hanging fruit, too. I don't... Like, Whitman got a lot of credit in the postseason last year for... allegedly stashing his like Paul Pierce at the four offense until the playoffs.
No,
I don't know.
And then all of a sudden
they come back this year and they're playing like they flip their style on its head and it hasn't worked out and they've had a ton of injuries, I know, but 15 and 18 for this team. I think
he's just a guy that like I think his winning percentage as a coach for his career is below 400. And he's got winning seasons turned in the last 3 years. So, like, even those seasons haven't been able to push that winning percentage to above 400. So, just kind of a guy that happened to be the coach of John Wall's team in the East when the East was about as bad as we've ever seen a conference the prior 3 years. It's a lot better now, and we're seeing what the Wizards are capable of when the rest of the conference is pretty solid. So... pretty easy to put him in the bottom five. So after Whitman, you know, third worst, then it might become a little interesting.
It's a little dicey now.
Because, like, I think you can make – for me, it was between Derek Fisher and Lionel Hollins for fourth worst and fifth worst in some order. I went Hollins, fourth worst, Fisher, fifth worst. But I don't think they're necessarily – train wrecks. Like, I think Holland's situation is interesting because I think he's kind of just mailing it in, and I mean, that team is not what he really signed up to be coaching. Fisher, I think it's maybe too early to say that he's a terrible coach, but I definitely don't think he's a good coach. I think both Hollins and Fisher probably get fired either this offseason or the next offseason. But those are the two guys I'm going with.
I didn't have Hollins in my bottom five. I think I'm gonna give him the benefit of the doubt because of what he was able to do in Memphis for those couple of years, getting to the conference semis, getting to the first round, getting to the conference finals. And then even last season, with Brooklyn, this is a team that got to the playoffs with a pretty underwhelming roster, and that roster's excuse me, my voice is going out of me today. That roster's even worse than it was last season. But did you know he coached the Vancouver Grizzlies, by the way? I did not know that. He was the coach of the Vancouver Grizzlies in 99, 2000.
I did know that.
They went 18-42 in a lockout shortened year. But, I mean, this is a guy, Lionel Hollins, 51% career winning percentage. Not great, but also not as bad as some of the guys in this bottom tier.
I was trying to basically sort of distinguish I think he's a guy that, the game sort of passed him by. Like, I think he was a good coach 5-10 years ago.
Sure.
Back, and I mean, he did sort of establish what the Grizzlies' identity has been for a while now with that core. But I just think in today's game, I can't see a job where I would be like, let's go get Lionel Hollins for that job. I think he's a guy that isn't really, his coaching style doesn't really work or translate in today's game.
I think that's true. Yeah, and that's kind of part of the reason that he ended up leaving Memphis, or the organization more or less parted ways with him. Is there a type of situation that you think he could, because he's still a good coach, right? he's not a guy that you say, this guy's a bad coach. He just seems to be a little bit out of touch or set in his ways.
I think he's one of the five worst coaches, so I will not. Okay, I ranked him as one of my five worst.
Well, I disagree with that. But, he's certainly not a top 10 coach, we'll say that. And he's probably not in the top half. But, I think he's still a guy that's well-respected around the league by some parties, at least. And I think there's, would you rather have him? I think, coaching a young team, I don't know if that's his area necessarily. I don't know if he does a whole lot better than Byron Scott. And I mean, Byron Scott, don't get us wrong, has set the bar just, unbelievably low with the Lakers. But I think Lionel Hollins, the reason that he fit with Memphis is, A, the personnel fit what he wanted to do, and B, he does better with competent.
I don't think you're going to see a personnel situation like Memphis open up maybe ever again.
That's true.
So I just don't see him as a guy that should be coaching really anymore.
Okay. Well, I went with Derek Fisher as my fourth worst, and I think you probably have him on your list at number five.
Yeah, I said he's at five.
Okay. So I had George Karl at my fifth worst, and he's, the track record, probably, he's not a bottom five coach in the league, but this season I think he might be, and he's put in a tough situation.
But they're one game back of the eight seed. I mean,
who I think is maybe the best – front court power forward in the league.
But I mean, they've never, I don't know. I look at that roster, and besides Cousins, it is kind of a testament to how bad the West is that they're in line. They could be in the hunt for playoff berth, but he's won pretty much everywhere he goes. And I think this is the worst roster he's really ever had. So, I mean, it's not surprising to me that he's under 500.
Yeah, I wasn't super confident in that one. It was hard to find another.
This would have been a lot easier to do a year ago because we would have had Scott Brooks in there. We would have had Jacque Vaughn in there.
Yep,
Jacque Vaughn. The NBA has kind of purged itself of most of the really bad coaches.
Really bad. There are bad coaches.
But, nobody that I felt really comfortable. That's the thing. It's I didn't feel great about putting Lionel Hollins or Derek Fisher in the bottom five. Definitely had no problem putting the other three in there, but a year ago this would have been a lot easier.
All right, so let's shift now to the top 10 coaches. We'll start with number 10 and we'll count.
Sure.
Let's count up. I mean, we know who number one is going to be on both of our lists, but who did you have at number 10?
I had Dave Yeager.
Dave Yeager. Okay, I had him a little bit higher. I went with Terry Stotts at number 10.
I had Terry Stotts at number 9. So.
Oh, really? I have Steve Clifford at number 9. Does Steve Clifford make your list?
He does not make my list.
Was he close?
He was close. He would have been top 15 for sure, maybe top 12. I think he's definitely a good coach. I hope that they hang on to him. Just don't really have a track record of him being a good coach in terms of wins and losses yet.
Yeah, that's true. I think he's one of those guys that you only hear positive things about him, whether it's from players or from other coaches around the league, you know, the work ethic, the scheme, and the way that he's been able to kind of play with two different sets. And, you know, last year this was a team that was really good defensively, really bad offensively. This year they're pretty good defensively and have really changed the way they play, and it's still working out for them. I mean, they're not in the playoffs right now, but they're right around 500. With considering all the injuries, I think that's fine.
And I think he's a guy that he kind of benefited a little bit from the Michael Kidd-Gilchrist injury, because that would have been put him in a really high degree of difficulty coaching spot to try to decide what to do there, whether to use Kidd-Gilchrist for his defense or to maybe just take a radical stance and play him very limited minutes because of his offensive limitations. Another guy that I actually just left off because he doesn't have the track record of wins and losses, for sort of the same reason I left Clifford off, was Mike Malone. I sort of considered him as, I think he's a good coach, but there's no real proof of it yet in terms of wins and losses. So we both had Stotts in our top 10, just barely. You have Jaeger in your top 10. I don't have Clifford in mine. At 8, I had Brad Stevens.
Down at number 8. Wow, I went quite a bit higher on Stevens. I have Dave Jaeger at 8, who we briefly touched on. Do you think Jaeger would have been higher last year? I feel like the public opinion has shifted maybe a little bit.
I don't know, because I think for him to have that Grizzlies team at 19-18, they're in line for the 6th seed, which is where they're supposed to be. He's not getting, you know, has anyone on that team been better this year than they were last year? Like, I don't think
it's false. That's a false statement.
So, like, that the fact that he's keeping this team above 500 while all of his players are turning in subpar seasons, like, that seems pretty impressive to me.
Yeah, and the 2 weeks ago, you know, the talk of him being fired, it seemed like it came down to like a one game playoff for his job, and that's kind of cooled off, which I think we both agree is the right move. Who'd you have at number 7?
I had Stan Van Gundy at number 7.
I had Stan Van Gundy as well. How much of that is past track record, you know, a guy who's been to a finals with Orlando versus what he's been able to do with this Detroit team?
It's just sort of the whole package, I guess. I mean, based on his track record, he's doing exactly what I expected him to do with this Detroit team. He was a guy that really, you know, he wasn't like D'Antoni level revolutionary in the way that he changed the way the game's played, but I think he's up there, and I think a lot of what you see today is because of what he was doing with those Magic teams. He's got a really great vision for what he wants to do personnel-wise. I think he so far the returns on him being a front office guy and a coach are pretty solid. You know, I think he's really done a good job at targeting the right guys to sort of fit that system. I think you look at the letting Greg Monroe walk and build around Drummond in the front court has paid off huge dividends. So, you know, I think he's just a really good basketball mind, a really good mind in terms of putting together a team. Felt like, to me, spots 4 through 8 could have been in really any order. So I could have had Stevens higher, I could have had Van Gundy higher, but just felt a bit more strongly about some other guys.
Okay. And yeah, like I said, I had Stan Van at 7 as well. Number 6, I went Eric Spoelstra. Where did you go there?
I had Mike Budenholzer for the Hawks. I think that he really has completely maximized the pieces he's been given in Atlanta. And we were talking in the office about you don't have Budenholzer on your list at all, and that's the one we disagree. Like, so you have Clifford and I have Budenholzer. The rest of our top 10 are all the same, just in different order. Budenholzer, kind of sketchy in terms of the way that things transpired with the GM situation there, but coaching wise, I think that he's really solid. I think he's probably the best piece of the Popovich coaching tree, and a guy that is going to have that team in the playoffs, I think, pretty much every single year going forward, almost regardless.
You think he's ahead of Bucks interim coach Joe Prunty on the Popovich coaching tree? I'm sure Prunty's higher up on this list. But I went Spoelstra. I think. Do you have Spoelstra on your list?
Number 5.
You have it at number 5. Yeah. Okay, so. I think there was kind of that. He was kind of in David Blatt territory a little bit when LeBron, you know, came to Miami during the start of what was Spoelstra's then third year. And, you know, it was, all right, this is a guy who won 43 and then 47, but he had Dwayne Wade. Now he gets LeBron and Bosh. He starts winning 58, and then he wins 46 in the lockout shortened year, and then 66. There's still that kind of lingering question of, you know, is this a product of LeBron and Wade and Bosh being there, or is it Spoelstra? And I think it's kind of bearing out that, you know, LeBron leaves and they become a 37-win team last year. So a ton of it was that. But at the same time, like, the respect for Spoelstra, I don't think, has waned, really.
Also, I think you can somewhat throw out last year just because you look at that personnel they were deploying last year versus this year. You look at how often Wade was out, Bosh missing.
Midseason trades.
I mean, like, there's just what are you going to do with that roster last year? I think I give him so much credit for being the only coach that's ever gotten LeBron to change the way LeBron plays offense. Like, LeBron's never, LeBron likes to dribble the ball at the top of the key and hold the ball and kind of run the offense that way. Spoelstra got him to kind of change that a little bit, got him to finally start posting up en route to those two titles. They probably should have only won one of those, but they got both of them. Think that there's a lot to be maybe desired in the way that he coaches offense in terms of scheming. I think that they kind of leave some stuff untapped, but defensively, I think he's great. I think that really good at managing minutes and rotations and stuff like that. So big fan of Spoes.
Okay, number five, you revealed that's where you have Spoelstra. Yeah. I went Steve Kerr at five, and he could certainly be higher, but one, we only have a very small sample size, and in that sample size, he did win the NBA title. But two, it's the same situation you can talk about with the Heat, where he has this incredible collection of players, and the argument against Kerr is that he hasn't coached this season, and they're just as good, if not better.
But do you think he's done anything, had anything to do with them being good?
Oh, I'm sure he has. I mean, he hasn't been on the sidelines, but he's been at most practices, from what I understand. I don't know how much he's traveling right now, and it sounds like he should be back soon. But, I mean, you know, there's something to be said for this.
I think the burying David Lee and putting Draymond in the starting lineup is probably the best regular season coaching move of the decade. Like, I think that is probably the number one thing I'd point to in terms of why they won the title and why they were so good last year and why they're so good this year. Recognizing Draymond Green, his unique abilities and his importance to the team in terms of being on the court, and recognizing that David Lee's a player that really doesn't fit in the NBA anymore. To me, that's enough to put him a little bit higher on the list. But I mean, all these coaches are really, really good, and I definitely get the small sample there, but I'm not going to hold anything about this year against what he did. I think that he laid all the groundwork for this year to be possible. That was your fifth, right?
That was my number. Yeah, that was my number five.
So at four, I had Frank Vogel.
So do I.
Nice.
Yeah, a lot of unanimous choices, I guess, for us here. But yeah, I mean, this one kind of goes without saying. I mean, he's
like total overachiever,
yeah.
Right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
Last year's team had no business winning as many games as it did. This year's team has no business winning
the only
as many
coach
games
who's been able to successfully harness Lance Stephenson.
Yes, yes.
They're five games back of Cleveland this year. Just
looking at the talent on that team that was the one seed in the East a few years ago, like, how is that team the one seed? Like, it's Paul George, Hibbert, David West, Lance, and George Hill, basically. And that was the best team in the league for most of the year. Like, that's incredible to me.
I mean, they did win the East regular season at least twice in a row, right?
And their defense has always just been elite, like, almost regardless of who the players are. So, big props to him. Definitely, like I said, for me, and my next one is, I have Steve Kerr at number three. For me, four, five, like Vogel, Spoelstra, Budenholzer, Van Gundy, Stevens, I'm fine with those guys in any order. But I just definitely think Vogel's done the most with the least.
All right, I went Stevens at three.
Okay.
And yeah, because I'm surprised you have him as low. I know you're high on him as a coach overall, and I don't know anyone who isn't, but do you think he just hasn't quite accomplished enough yet?
Yeah, I just think... I think it's easy to kind of fall in love with him as a coach because of how sort of accessible he is in interviews. And, you know, I think that he just hasn't really accomplished anything. And I think he's done a lot with a little as well, but he hasn't done as much with a little as maybe some of these other guys. I think he's been given kind of a really tricky roster to manage this year, so yep. I don't hold a ton of that against him. But, you know, I'd like to see him X and O with the best in a postseason series, you know, and make adjustments like that in a postseason series. I've never seen him do that. So
it was kind of surprising how easily Boston bowed out last year. And it was a good Cavs team, but it was a hampered mm-hmm. Cavs team at that, and it still really wasn't a series at all. So our top two are going to be the same then, right?
Yeah,
Carlisle two, Pop one. Yep, so Carlisle, I mean, 11 postseasons in 13 years, probably going to make that 12 out of 14 this year. And then Pop, I mean, the Bill Belichick of the NBA, really, there's really no parallel. You'd be kind of, it would be insane to put anyone other than Pop at the top.
Right, and honestly, I feel the same way about Carlisle at two. Like, I think
guys like Stevens and Vogel could get there, but Carlisle's body of work.
He's just got that ship running so smoothly. I mean, you look at what he was able to do with Monte Ellis last year. I mean, the fact that he's been able to successfully build an offense around a super aging Dirk and have pieces, you know, guys like Jameer Nelson and Devin Harris.
Raymond Felton playing
J.J. Barea, like, playing major roles, like, won a title with Deshaun Stevenson and Jet Terry as, like, two huge cogs in their backcourt.
Deshaun Stevenson.
I mean, it just...
Deshaun Stevenson, who has an ATM in his living room.
Like, Deshaun Stevenson, that was, like, Deshaun Stevenson's last relevant moment in the NBA. I think he went on, like, a month-long bender after that title.
Sure he did.
And he's never been heard from again. So, like, just kind of an amazing job. And the fact that he... I would have just loved to have been in the room when the Mavs were debating that Rondo trade last year because I refuse to believe that Carlisle signed off on that, and he ended up probably being right there.
The other thing, just a quick sidebar, I'm not taking anything away from Carlisle. Is like, look what Rondo's doing in Sacramento, and like, yeah, there are seven games under 500, but like, his numbers are great. He's back to vintage Rondo. Like, do you think part of it was that Carlisle never really put him in positions to succeed, well, whether he liked the trade or not?
I just think you can't build your offense to suit Rondo. Like, I mean, he had an offense that was the most efficient offense in the league prior to the Rondo trade. I just think he was stubborn in the sense that he was just like, I have such a good thing going here.
Yeah.
Like, why am I going to change this to accommodate Rondo? Like,
it's like, there's a 20% chance we'll get a lot better. There's a 50% chance we'll get a lot worse. And then
I think he just looked at the rest of the pieces on the roster and was like, I mean, we're not built to be this like defensive, you know, slow paced juggernaut, really. I think he just kind of refused to go that way. And I think that it obviously didn't work out. And, you know, I look at the team right now, look at how good they're doing. Relative to the rest of the West, which has completely fallen off. They're one of the only teams that, you know, kind of are locks, I would say, at this point to make the playoffs outside of those kind of elite four at the top there. And you look at their roster compared to the teams below them, it's not that different. talent-wise.
Not at all. And the big thing that puts Carlisle over some of these other guys is, one, longevity. You know, Stevens and Vogel still relatively young, but he's won the title, and he won it with a team that
was
historically
huge underdogs
won. And historically, like that team compares relatively favorably to some of those Pacers teams, and they couldn't get over the hump. Like, Carlisle not only got to the finals, he also beat the team that everybody thought was basically unbeatable.
And he should have, like, he had the best team in the finals before against the Heat in 06.
Ugh.
And that probably had nothing to do with him and a lot to do with the
Dwayne
free
Wade
throw
free throw.
the Dwayne
free
Wade
throw
free throw strategy.
They were up 2-0 in that, right?
Yeah.
And like, close to going up 3-0.
And yeah, I mean, that Mavs fans are never going to live that one down. But
vividly remember watching those games at a basketball camp in the great city of Stevens Point, Wisconsin. But yeah, we'll finish up with that. We had some more stuff. I feel like this happens every week. We get onto topics and get far too deep into them. But I think this was interesting. Hopefully, your listeners feel the same
way. Hit us up if you
please. Are you listening? Are there listeners? I don't know. Hopefully. But again, we are sponsored by DraftKings. Fantasy football may be winding down, although DraftKings does have wild card weekend and divisional weekend contests that will be running. But either way, with football season winding down, you can get into DFS NBA. That's something you can play just about any night. I think from here on out until the All-Star break, or other than the All-Star break, there's at least one or two games every single day until late April. So definitely get in on the DFS action at DraftKings. That's America's favorite one-week fantasy football site. You can win enormous cash prizes every week. That promo code, ROTOHOOPS, if you use that, you'll be able to get a match on your deposit, if it's your first deposit, that is, on DraftKings.com. So head over to DraftKings.com now. Again, enter that promo code ROTOHOOPS for free entry. DraftKings.com, bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Enter ROTOHOOPS for free now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com, that's DraftKings.com.